Good morning, everyone. Welcome to those of you joining us online, staying home on this rainy day. We're a little jealous, right? If you would, pull out either a piece of paper or your sermon notes, if you would, as well as a pen or a pencil. And here's what I want for us to do. If you do not have sermon notes, I want to encourage you on a piece of paper to draw a small box. Now, I promise this is as complicated as it'll get, okay? So if you're artistically challenged like me, no worries on this one, all right? This is about as hard as it's going to get. If you do have sermon notes, you're going to notice a box has already been provided for you, and so you can use that. And once you have that piece of paper with the box on it, I'm just going to ask you to hang on to it, okay? We're going to come back to this box. Recently, we looked at a study of our surrounding zip code, which actually led to this series, and it was clear when we took some time to kind of unpack that study that we live in a fairly successful part of the world, even the United States. In fact, many would say that life is good. A lot of people would say life is good. Yet underneath the surface, when you start peeling back the layers, people still feel a sense of emptiness. They still feel empty. Now, I think there could be a lot of reasons for emptiness. I think the feeling of emptiness could be connected to a relationship. It could be connected to a loss or circumstances or addiction or depression or anxiety or physical health or mental well-being. And the list, I think, goes on. There are a number of reasons for emptiness. And I think that all of those reasons are important to address in one's life. They really are. But there's another reason, more particularly, when my life seems to be going well, when my life seems good, and it is a question of meaning. It's a question of purpose. And the question is, why am I even here? Why am I even doing this? Why do I even get up in the morning? Why was I even born? Why do I exist? About 10 years ago this month, Heidi and I found out that we were going to be part of bringing a new life into the world, and one of the things that we did was to attend a birthing class. And during the class, I learned a lot about how to be a coach for my wife. And they gave a lot of advice. For instance, they said, when you are feeling some discomfort, okay, they never used the word pain. They used the word discomfort. In fact, I talked with someone more recently who also helped bring this little baby into the world, and in their class, they didn't even use the word discomfort, they used the word sensations, okay? Because they, you know, probably they thought they don't want to psych people out. So, but in our case, they used the word discomfort, but they said, when you're feeling some discomfort, a cool, damp cloth on the forehead might be refreshing. And so the class helped me, you know, with the whole teaching, whole coaching deal, and then the day came when Heidi went into labor. My wife Heidi went into labor, and it lasted for hours. And at one point, the contractions were getting stronger and stronger and stronger, more intense, and so I decided to apply my learning. I got a cool, damp cloth, and there's some disagreement here on whether the cloth was damp or it was dripping wet, but it was at least cool. And I placed it ever so gently and lovingly on my wife's tender forehead. And then, to my surprise, despite all my amazing learning and training, my amazing wife did something uncharacteristic. She grabbed that cloth, and she looked at me with a look that I will never, ever forget. And she said, "Get this thing off of me." And she grabbed that cloth, and she hurled it across the room, right? Now, why did my amazing wife, Heidi, do this? Well, I guess she was experiencing some sensations, right? But then our daughter arrives, and it was the closest thing to a miracle that I had ever seen, and it was so amazing. Heidi was amazing. And it seemed like after it was all over, the discomfort, the sensations, the pain was worth it. And the question becomes, why? Why was the pain so worth it? Why was it so worth it? Because of the purpose that lied on the other side of the pain. There was purpose for the pain. And it's a funny thing. If someone were to ask you, you know, when you were born, most people know the answer to that question. But the real question is, why were you born? And they don't print that on birth certificates, do they? But wouldn't that be nice? And when people don't know the answer to that question, they start to die a little bit on the inside. Now, I want to be clear about something from the onset. There will always be a certain amount of emptiness, a certain amount of pain in this life. This is true of my own life as well. In fact, Jesus says to his friends one day in John chapter 16, verse 33, Jesus says to his friends, in this world you will have trouble. Sometimes we're surprised by this. We're surprised by trouble. I can't believe there's trouble. But you will have trouble, okay? There will always be trouble in the world. But here's the thing. The right purpose redeems the trouble. The right purpose redeems the inevitable pain. The right purpose redeems a sense of emptiness in our lives. The real tragedy, I think, in this life is not when someone goes through it with pain, because everyone will have some and some will have much. The great tragedy is when someone goes through it and they never know why. They never know why they were born. They never truly know why they got up every day. There's an author and businessman named Bob Buford. He wrote about this in a book. Bob had reached all the goals that he had set for himself by the time he was in his early 40s. In his early 40s, he had reached all the goals that he had set. He was the president and CEO of a tremendously successful cable TV company. He had a happy marriage. He had a beautiful home. He had numerous toys. He was financially secure and independently wealthy. Yet although people said that his life was successful from the outside, he still felt a sense of emptiness. He was not satisfied with his sense of meaning and his sense of purpose. And so what he did is he hired a very bright business consultant to meet with him and his wife, Linda. And the business consultant's name was Mike. And Mike was not a churchgoer, but he had a fabulous mind. And so Mike asked Bob and Linda a single question. He took out a sheet of paper, much like I asked you to take out a sheet of paper, and he sketched a box on it, and then he asked them this question. What's in the box for you? What's in the box for you? And so Bob asked Mike, the business consultant, to explain it. So Mike told him about a time when he worked with Coca-Cola, and they decided that the main thing that their company was about was great taste. Those were the words they used. So they put the words great taste in that box. And that was years and years later, after Coca-Cola had been around for many years. And this led the Coca-Cola company to develop a product called New Coke. Does anybody remember New Coke? It was a company disaster, all right? And so Mike came in as a business consultant and said to the Coke guys, your problem is that you put the wrong words in the box. And so he asked, what's the mainspring, the driving force for why Coca-Cola exists? So they went back to the drawing board, and the new phrase they came up with was American tradition. And this led them back to Classic Coke, and as a result, their company recovered. And so here's Mike sitting down with Bob and Linda, and he says, you have to be really clear about the central purpose, the driving force of your life. I mean, you got to be really clear on this. And Mike said, I've been talking with the two of you long enough, he said, to know that it's one of two things. It's either money, and he drew a dollar sign outside of the box, or it's Jesus, and he drew a cross. And then he asked him, again, what's in the box for you? And Bob writes, no one had ever put such a significant question to me so directly. I sat there stunned by the implications of this decision. Linda, my wife, appeared no less stunned. I could see the stereotypical images of ministers, missionaries, and monks passing through their mind, right? Would we have to give up away all our money? Would we be required to dress like a minister and a spouse? This isn't that bad, is it? Right? Now, Bob wrote this in a book called Halftime. The book is about wrestling with this question, because every human being has to answer this question at some point in their life, whether consciously or unconsciously. What are you going to put in the box? And I believe that the answer to this question can mean the difference between emptiness and fullness at the end of our lives. It will mean the difference between emptiness and fullness at the end of our lives. So I want to explore that together with you. And to do this, I want to focus on an individual today. There was one man who said one day that he would devote his life to an experiment, to in a sense try and determine what ought to go in that box. And he wrote a book about it. And the book is called, and thousands of years later, people are still reading this book, and the book is called Ecclesiastes. It's found in the Old Testament of the Bible, the first major section of the Bible, and so feel free, if you have a Bible, you can certainly turn there, but we're going to work through a number of verses. And Ecclesiastes begins by saying this. This is how the book begins, okay? This is found in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1. It says, the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Now, I want you to notice the word teacher here. That word teacher is actually very difficult to translate from the Hebrew language into the English. In fact, there's a translator by the name of Eugene Peterson who instead uses the word quester, the words of the quester, son of David, king in Jerusalem. And the reason for this is it's really the book is about a quest on what basically belongs in the box. It's kind of this discovery process for this quester of what belongs in the box. And it's the quest of a man named Solomon. Solomon is the quester, okay? He is the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And Solomon was in a unique position to carry out this kind of experiment because he had wealth and power and time and ability far exceeded any of those on the planet, okay? Moreover, you got to know this about Solomon. He was not a dabbler. Solomon was not a dabbler. In this book, Solomon will say words like, I applied myself to it, I tested it, I undertook it, I built it, I made it, I bought it, I amassed it, and he even goes as far as saying, I became it. Okay, that's as far down that road that Solomon would go. In other words, once Solomon decided that he was going to try something, he devoted himself to it. He walked as far down that road as humanly possible, trying to put different things in the box. But ultimately, it did not satisfy. Each of those roads ultimately led to a sense of emptiness, led to a lack of meaning, a lack of purpose. And so here's what I want to do. I want to mention just a few of those roads that Solomon walked down. And then I want to ask us the question, what are we going to put in the box? What are we going to put in the box? So let's start with the first one, and it's the word wisdom. We actually have a picture of a box with a book in it to represent wisdom. Solomon tried putting human wisdom and knowledge in the box. Okay, let's take a look. Here's what it says in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 13. It says this. Hopefully the words will pop. I applied my mind. Now notice the words, I applied my mind. In other words, he devoted himself to this. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. And Solomon became really, really, really smart. In fact, in 1 Kings chapter 4, verses 29 through 31, we are told that God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. Goes on to say that Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the people of the East and greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than anyone else, including Ethan the Ezrahite, wiser than Haman, Calcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahal. Okay? Now, does anybody know who these four people are? I don't either, okay? This is the only time they're mentioned in the Bible. But they were obviously smart enough to mention in this book, all right? And in other words, it was no contest. I mean, compared to Solomon, it was like they were in kindergarten and he was in grad school. It was like they were from the University of Minnesota and he was from the University of Minnesota. They were from the University of Iowa and he was from the University of Minnesota. Am I right? I just slammed an entire university, didn't I? I just want you to know we're going to talk about judgmentalism next week. And I might need to be there for that message, okay? But it was no contest at all. Solomon's reputation for wisdom was so great that the queen of Sheba, the head of the state, comes to test him with the hard questions. And when Sheba saw all his wisdom and observed all his wise decisions and organizational genius, it says at the end of 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 5, that she was overwhelmed. Now, this word overwhelmed is like it took her spirit. It took her breath away. That's the idea in the Hebrew language. It took her breath away. Now, let me ask you the question. I think we live in a fairly bright part of the world, well-educated part of the world. When is the last time that someone said to you of your wisdom, oh, that just took my breath away? How many of you are married and your spouse has looked at you and said, oh, your wisdom just took my breath away, right? Or maybe a friend or a coworker or somebody else. Well, Solomon, the wisest person who ever lived, he walks down that road, but he discovers something strange. Have you ever noticed this? Smart people can do some really foolish things. I'm going to share a very embarrassing story with you. It took me a year to even come to this place that I want to share this story with you, okay? And my wife has kindly instructed me to make sure that you all know that, according to her, naively, I generally have good judgment and wisdom. I'm fairly well educated. I'm not easily fooled. She told me to tell you that because, according to her, this was one of those moments in our lives together, and we've been together for a while, when apparently I was none of those things. Okay? So here's what happened. One day, I'm in the crawl space, and I noticed a large tear in some flexible air ducting in our crawl space. But here was the problem. The flexible air ducting was pushed tightly through a small hole in the drywall, and I could not repair it without widening the opening of the drywall. But I didn't want to widen it too much because I knew that would cause, it would just be too extensive. I didn't want it too large of a gap. And so you got to picture this flexible air ducting going through some drywall, and it goes up and it's attached to this other piece of duct. And so what I had to do is I had to buy some supplies because the flexible ducting had a hole in it and air was just pouring out of it. And so I bought the supplies. I get downstairs in the crawl space, and it's a very tight corner of the crawl space, maybe 3 feet tall. And here I am. I'm starting to cut the drywall to be able to open a little bit so it's not so tight, so I could get my hand in there to take, first of all, to rip off the old ducting and take off the old duct tape from the ducting, pull it out, and then bring in the new flexible air ducting and tape it back on. And I'm telling you, it was not fast. It was not easy. It took about an hour, and I may or may not have expressed some outward frustration while I was doing it, okay? Mostly grunts, like, because it was as far as my arm could reach. And after I got close to done the project, I looked through the opening in the drywall, just the crack in the drywall that I had opened it up a little bit more, and noticed something amazing. There's actually a large space hidden on the other side of the drywall. Okay, it seemed like the builder actually drywalled over a small room. And it was dark on the other side of it, but I even noticed what looked like a large tank, almost like a water heater hiding in there. Okay? And I thought to myself, I mean, this is fascinating, right? I mean, there's kind of a history around our house anyway, and I thought, you know, maybe they just drywalled over this small room and they couldn't use that space. I don't know what it is, but it looks like there's another room back there. And I go upstairs and I tell my wife Heidi about it, and her response to me was, "You mean the furnace room?" I said, "No." I declared this confidently. "No, all right, it is not the furnace room. There's a whole other room back there." "Yeah, the furnace room. No, I'm telling you, there's even a large tank, almost like a water heater back there." "Yes, the water heater in the furnace room." And then she looks at me and she says, "Oh, did you have to reach from the crawl space in and try to replace this flexible ducting and reach up there? I mean, you probably could have done it all right from the furnace room." And suddenly it got quiet and less confident. I said, "What?" And she says, "Yeah, come, let's look together." And so we marched downstairs, opened the furnace room door, and right there in plain sight and eye level and easily accessible is my workmanship, right? I mean, I'll show you a picture. I mean, just fresh ducting. Here's a picture of it. There's the drywall. The crawl space is on the other side of the wall. And what I had done is I reached my arm out there, tried to take the duct tape off, put it back up there, and duct tape it back on. And there it was in plain view. Here's the water heater. Here's the furnace, right? And she looks at me, and she pats me on the back and says, "Wow, that pretty impressive job." Right? Oh, man. So I guess, according to my wife, supposedly wise people do some really foolish things, right? Even fairly well-educated people. And so Solomon, I mean, he walks down that road farther than those before him. Now, you got to understand, education is not necessarily a bad thing, all right? Some of you might be students in this room. Education is not necessarily a bad thing. I don't want to get in trouble for that, okay? A 70% is great. No, I'm just kidding, all right? I'm going to get in trouble for that. But education is not necessarily bad, but Solomon made it the mainspring. He made it the driving force in his life. And so he says to himself in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 16, he says, "Look, I've increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I've experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself, I devoted myself to the understanding of wisdom. I also have madness and folly," like someone trying to put duct tape or ducting through a drywall, right? "But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind." And then he goes on to say, "Last, for with much wisdom comes much sorrow." I've seen a lot of the deepest academics in our world apply themselves to knowledge and experience this in their life. Much sorrow much grief. In other words, these things do not ultimately satisfy. They do not ultimately fulfill life and eradicate emptiness. They do not fill the box. So then he tried another option. And I'm going to show you another picture of a box, and it's the word pleasure. And I put a cookie in the middle of this box. I'm going to explain why I put a cookie in that box in just a few moments. But Solomon said to himself in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 1, he said, I said to myself, come, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. So he tested, put pleasure in that box to find what is good. And so Solomon tests himself with pleasure, right? This includes food, it includes houses, I mean, things that are beautiful, vineyards, gardens, parks, reservoirs, music. He constructs a magnificent palace. How many of you have ever been involved in a remodeling project? Raise your hand. Just involved in a lot of you in this room have been involved in a remodeling project. Well, it took 13 years to complete the construction of this palace. That is quite a remodeling project. Want to know how many people were on this construction crew? Over 150,000 people. All right? It was a nice palace. And so the scriptures actually say that Solomon made silver as common as stones. And then Solomon says in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 3, I tried cheering myself with wine, right? And a lot of people have tried that, am I right? Not here. But a lot of people have tried that, right? And embracing folly, all right? Embracing folly. He devoted himself to sexual pleasure. In fact, the Bible says that he has 700 wives and 300 concubines, okay? He's supposed to be the wisest, smartest guy in the world. And he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. I'll let that one sink in for a moment. That's not good for him. It's not good for the wives. But here's how Solomon sums up this whole journey. This is a fabulous summation, I think, in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 10. Solomon says, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I denied myself nothing that my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. I mean, that's how far Solomon goes. In other words, I looked at it, I wanted it, I had it. There's a character on a show called Sesame Street. Anyone remember Sesame Street? Anybody remember Cookie Monster, right? And Cookie Monster's philosophy of life is pretty much this. I mean, this kind of wraps it up. He says, me see cookie, me want a cookie, me eat cookie, right? Well, Solomon walked down that road, a road that a lot of people, I think, in our day say belongs in that box. And he ate a lot of cookies. That's what that verse says. And I'm telling you, there are really bright, really smart people that will stay up late at night trying to convince you that pleasure is worth your full devotion and time. They'll say that. But Solomon says this instead in Ecclesiastes chapter 6, verse 7. He says, everyone's toil, everyone's efforts is for their mouth, yet their appetite is never satisfied. It's never satisfied. In other words, some of you might think that there is some pleasure, some experience, some relationship, some thrill, some gratification, that if I just had that, or if I just had that, or if I just had that one, or that experience, or whatever that might be. Solomon, in a sense, says, try it if you want it, but that's not it. It does not ultimately satisfy, it does not ultimately fulfill life and eradicate the emptiness. It will not, at the end of the day, fill that box. So he tried another option, one that I think a lot of people try today, especially in this part of the world, and it's the word success, okay? I'm going to show you just a picture of a dollar sign in that box, just to represent success generally. In fact, Solomon climbed the ladder of success higher than anyone in this place. Anyone in this place. He became the most successful king in the history of Jerusalem. He extended the country's border farther than it had ever been extended before, and that country's borders had ever been extended after. And we're told in 1 Kings 10 that Solomon actually had a salary. Check, just listen to this. He had a salary that included 25 tons of gold every year. This was thousands of years ago, 25 tons of gold every year, and that was above and beyond the taxes and the trade profits that he received above and beyond that. Okay, that is a lot of money, am I right? And we're told in chapter 10, verse 23, that King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all other kings of the earth. right? I mean, the whole world. He was more successful than anyone. And it goes on to say that the whole world sought audience with Solomon. Right? No one had ever climbed the ladder of success like Solomon. Yet here was his response in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 11. He says, "Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. It led to a sense of emptiness, purposelessness, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun." In other words, that's not it. It will not ultimately satisfy. It will not ultimately fulfill life and eradicate the emptiness. It will not, at the end of your life, fill that box. It's just not. And Solomon realized that for something to be worthy of being putting in the box, it would have to pass what's called the eternity test. Because he recognized the temporal things on this side of life. In fact, Solomon uses some very colorful metaphors toward the end of the book to describe what happens to human beings, no matter who they are, whether they're rich or poor, whether they've experienced a lot of success, pleasure, and wisdom or not, whether big or small, whatever that might be. But he uses these colorful images right here at the end of Ecclesiastes to kind of describe what happens to human beings. And see if you can actually figure out what these colorful metaphors represent. Solomon writes this, and this is in Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 1. He says, "Remember your Creator in the days of your youth before the days of trouble come." Now, what are the days of trouble? Well, the days of trouble are the days toward the end of your life when everything starts to fall apart, right? And interesting that he uses the word trouble there. And later, Jesus will use a similar word. Trouble's coming in this life. So he says, "Remember your Creator in the days of your youth before the days of the trouble come." And it's kind of interesting that, you know, it's this idea that, you know, everything's falling apart. And of course, in that day, they didn't have things to make it look like they're all holding together like we do in our day. And so Solomon uses, again, these colorful images. He goes on to say, look at verse 3 at this point. He says, "When the grinders cease because they are few." Now, what do you think the grinders stand for here? Anybody want to take a stab at this? Teeth, right? They stand for our teeth. In other words, when your teeth start to go, and of course there were no fluoride treatments in those days, there were no dentists or implants or dentures, and so when your teeth started to go, I mean, they started to go, right? And they became few. And then Solomon goes on to say, and those looking through the windows grow dim. Now, what do you think the windows are? Eyes, right? Now we're catching on the colorful metaphors that Solomon's using here. It represents our eyes. And again, there was no LASIK surgery in those days. There were no glasses or contacts. I mean, when the windows grew dim, right, the windows grew dim. And then verse 4 goes on to say that when people rise up at the sound of the birds, but all their songs grow faint. Now, what's going on here? Ears, right? The hearing is starting to go. And it's when you reach a point when you can no longer hear very well, and the sounds of the birds in the morning begin to grow faint. And then verse 5, check this one out. When the grasshopper drags itself along. Now that's a colorful image, isn't it? Right? I mean, when the grasshopper drags itself along, right? In other words, the grasshoppers get up and go has got up and gone. Even a triple espresso no longer gets that grasshopper going anymore, right? And then last, when the skin under the elbows get all baggy and wrinkly. I made that one up. That's actually not in the Bible, but... but it's reality, am I right? It's starting to happen to me right now, right? So Solomon, in a sense, says, the grinders are going to go, the windows are going to get dim, the birds are going to get faint, the grasshopper is going to wear out, and that person who's you will go out of this world just as it came into this world, with nothing. And so we have to answer the question, what are you going to put in the box? What are we going to put in the box? And I'll tell you, Solomon in a sense says in these verses, it better be stronger than aging. It better be stronger than ailing health. And it better be stronger than even death. It better be something that will outlast all those other things. And if you want to, you can become smarter, you can become happier, richer, stronger, more successful, and so on. You can walk those roads as far as you want, but just know that the smartest person who ever lived went farther down those roads than you and I ever will. And here's what he discovered at the end of the road. It's a dead end. It's a dead end. I like this quote. It comes from the great theologian and scholar by the name of Jim Carrey. And Carrey put it like this. He said, "I think everybody should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so they can see that it's not the answer." I'd love to tell them what the answer is. Because those other things, it's a dead end. You and I were made for so much more. In fact, better yet, here's what Solomon says. This is found in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 11. Solomon says that he, referring to God has also set eternity in the human heart. He has also set eternity in the human heart. God has set eternity in the hearts of human beings. And so the question becomes, not only for Solomon, but for all of us as well, what's going to fill that box when we look back at the end of our lives? What are you going to put in that box? And I think one of the dangers of asking that question here is that many of us know the answer we're supposed to give because this is church. I recall a story from years ago. It was about a Sunday school teacher, and the Sunday school teacher asks a kid in the Sunday school class, Sunday school teacher asks, "What's brown and has a long tail and stores nuts for the winter?" And the kid says, "Well, I guess the answer is Jesus, but it sure sounds like a squirrel to me," right? You see, something happens, I think, when people get into church. People think, "Well, I guess the answer is Jesus because that's the answer I'm supposed to give." And I say this because a lot of people in our society have spent years, maybe their whole lives, giving obedience to Jesus. But secretly in their heart, they think, you know, if I were really free to chase these other things down the road, way down the road, these other things besides Jesus, that would be the good stuff. That would ultimately satisfy. That would fulfill life. That would fill the box. That would eradicate the emptiness that I'm experiencing. But here's what happens instead. They end up living a life of perpetual grudging. They end up living a life of perpetual frustration. And they're kind of caught I don't know how to express this exactly, but they're trapped between the desires that they're afraid to fully chase and the obedience they don't want to fully give. And they're caught. They're trapped. Or instead of just secretly thinking it, they actually chase after those other things. They try to put Jesus in the box, and they try to put all these other things in the box as well. And in other words, they give obedience to Jesus, but only in certain areas of their life. And then they kind of give obedience to these other things in their lives. And they think that will ultimately satisfy, that will fulfill life, that will eradicate the emptiness. But instead, here's what happens. In the words of James, one of Jesus' followers, and I've seen this lived out in people's lives, people become double-minded, and they become unstable in what they do. That's the way James puts it, like a wave of the sea blown and tossed by the wind. And they're caught in between a settled trust and confidence in God and a settled trust and confidence in these other things. And it kind of looks like this image here. All these things in the box, and it's just chaotic. And it's not that wisdom, pleasure, and success are necessarily bad. They're not necessarily bad, but it's when these things start to become the mainspring, the primary drivers of our lives, where we allow them to take different, you know, somehow think we can do this by saying, "Oh, this, I'll let Jesus be the driver in this area of my life, Jesus be the driver in this area of my life, I'm going to let other things be the primary driver in these areas of my life." And it becomes chaotic. And so Solomon, in a sense, says, you know what? If you really think that satisfaction belongs down one of those other roads, then you know what? Go down that road. Go as far as you can. Stop living life where you're trapped in between different gods. But if you do, you got to remember this. Someone went farther down those roads than you and I ever will. And it leads to a dead end. It leads to a dead end. What Solomon discovered was God set eternity in human hearts. And if you try to take God out of the equation, if you try to take God out of the picture, it's pretty hard to come up with a purpose that is stronger than aging, stronger than ailing health, and stronger than even death. It is pretty difficult to come up with one. But here's the good news. God has no intention of leaving you or me in the dark about where we can find ultimate satisfaction and fulfillment. God made you to know him. He made you to enjoy him. He made you to love him. He made you to love others and to live with him for in eternity. And Jesus will walk you, I think, through that process. He really will. And if you're ready, I mean, if you're listening to this today saying, that's me, I find it could be helpful to solidify that process. In the beginning of the message, I asked you to draw a box. For others of you, that box is found on your sermon notes. And if you know enough about Jesus to know that he loves you, if you know enough about Jesus to know that he made you, that he died on a cross for the forgiveness of your sin, if you know enough about Jesus that he rose from the dead and he wants to give you life, and you want to put him in the center, if that's you today, I want to encourage you to take this step. Simply with a pen or pencil, right now. Maybe you've been distracted. Maybe you committed a long time, yeah, God, I want you to be the center of life, but man, my life looks a lot more like that box with all the other things in it. But maybe today you want to take a step. And sometimes I think it can help to solidify the process. Here's what I want you to do. Take a pen or pencil and put a cross in that box. Just a cross. I think this is a simple way to say, okay, God, okay, Jesus, I want you to be it. I want you to be at the center of my life. I want you to fill my life. I want you to fill every crevice of this box. And I want you to know, if you're putting Jesus in the box, it's going to be a journey. You're going to have a lot of work to do and to figure out, to discern how Jesus would like you to arrange your life around him. But if it is Jesus, your box can begin, I think, to look something like this, where Jesus is at the center and you're learning to arrange your life and all these other things around him. And again, I want to be clear, in the words of Jesus, in this world, you're going to have trouble. Even with Jesus as a center and primary driver, there will always be trouble in this world. But here's the deal. The right purpose redeems the inevitable pain. And the right purpose redeems a sense of emptiness. In other words, Jesus will ultimately give you a life of greater meaning and greater purpose and greater fulfillment than all those other things. And at the end of your life, you and I will not regret it. We will not regret it. And so if that's you, I just want to give you a few ideas to continue to help solidify that process. Early in the service, Cindy mentioned this, that we have two groups coming up that are available for us, and they start tomorrow evening. One's called Christianity Explored, the other is called Discipleship Explored. And both of these groups differently, I think, provide an opportunity to learn about what it means to have the Jesus at the center of our life and how to arrange our lives around him. And both of those groups, again, they start tomorrow evening at 6:30. You can sign up, even if you missed it. You can sign up at the kiosk, or you can go online and sign up there. And I think it's important to get connected in groups like this. I think sometimes people think, you know, I can discover my purpose. I can discover what goes into the box all by myself. But we really can't, because our purpose is not just about our own fulfillment. It's about others as well. And so part of our purpose is to be in community. Not long ago, during a gathering, a large gathering, there was a woman in our church who noticed a young couple with their kids in the auditorium right here in this room. And so she introduced herself to that couple. And the couple was going through a significant struggle. They had not been in church in a while. It was so cool that they were here on that day. And so the woman, as they're walking out of the auditorium, asked the couple if she could pray for them. And just outside the auditorium's doors, they all held hands. And she thanked God for bringing them to this event. And she prayed over the wellness for their marriage and the wellness of their family. And there was a fairly sizable crowd here at this gathering, just mingling around the halls. But nonetheless, here are these three individuals right outside these doors, holding hands and praying. Now, do you think anyone complained about this? Do you think anybody said, oh, you know, look at that, they're in the way of others? No way. If anything, there were people watching there thinking, and watching this prayer, thinking to themselves, I wish that I could get in on that. I wish that I could get prayed for in this way. I wish that I could be a part of a community like that one.
See, part of the purpose for which God has made you and I is to be part of a community like that. Everyone needs God. Part of your purpose is to know him and grow in him and to be on mission with him and learn how to arrange your life around him. And part of your purpose is to be in community. And so I hope if this is you today that you will take advantage of that. And last, I hope that you'll join us for the rest of this series. Next week, we'll be answering the question, why are Christians so judgmental? I need to be there for that one. And then we're going to cap off the series by answering the question, what does it really mean to be a Christian? I mean, if you were to strip everything away, make it clear to me, keep it basic, what does it really mean? And so if you don't know God yet, you're still in explorer mode, man, I'm just so glad you're here. I hope you come back. I really do. Or maybe you've been following Jesus for a long time. I hope you bring someone else along. That's part of our purpose. Whether it's for the rest of this series or even bring somebody to Christian Explorer, bring somebody to Discipleship Explorer. Amen? Amen. Let's pray. Father, very simply, just help us to put you at the center of our lives. Help us to arrange our lives around you, God. And I just ask, wherever we're at in this journey, that you would reveal yourself, reveal your words, just reveal your ways to us. And I want to thank you for giving us a life. Your willingness to give us a life of greater meaning and greater purpose and greater fulfillment than all these other things through your son, Jesus. And it's in his name that we pray these things, in the name of Jesus. And all God's people said, amen.